to Disc 3 of Confronting the Taskmasters of Your Life. For those who would like, we'll share information on how you can obtain material produced for Shiloh Place Ministries following the message.
The second session, if you want to put a title on it, we call it Giving Birth to Deliverance. Giving Birth to Deliverance, or the subtitle is The Beginning of Birth Pains. Just even as I think of that title, I think of John 16, verse 20, that truly, truly I say to you that you will keep, that you will weep and lament. But the world will rejoice, you will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will be turned to joy. That whenever a woman is in travail, she has sorrow, because her hour has come. But when she gives birth to the child, she remembers the anguish no more, for that a child has been born into the world. And see, I believe the church corporately throughout the nations, churches individually in their corporate bodies, and us individually, whether in our family structures or us ourselves, are in a beginning of birth pains. That all that we see taking place in the natural, Paul said in Corinthians, first the natural, I believe, 1 Corinthians 15, 20-something. First the natural, then the spiritual. And what we see happening in the natural, in the great anxiety and fear and uncertainty and wars that are taking place, what's happening in this region, what's happening in the natural is also happening in the spiritual realm. There's a stirring, there's a great dissatisfaction, there's a suffering that's going on within many people's lives, and especially within us as Christians. We're just, most of us, well, if you're here on a Friday morning, it's probably all of us, unless your wife made you come, but we're no longer satisfied with status quo. We're no longer satisfied with normal Christianity. And there's a stirring, there's a birth pain that is beginning to occur. It's a suffering that we're going through. And I look back at the 1980 to really 1997, all that suffering that took place in my life. And then the verse that we just read, that when the child is born, I mean, you don't remember the anguish. Oh, I can describe it. Yes, I can remember it. But to see what God's done is, as He's led me out of the rigor and captivity of that system and brought it into the fulfillment of the Word He's given me. First, your family's going to be healed and restored, and then healing and restoration to the nations. And the sufferings of those years don't near compare with the glory of the now. With knowing every day, all over the world, that people's lives are being impacted because of the covenant. Because I was faithful to say, I'll not have my identity in Egypt. I'll not let my bones, my identity rest in all the betrayal I've been through. I'll not let it be hooked into now that we're in the palace. No, no, what you're bringing into our life is not for me. It's for the nations, a preserver of the nations of the earth, bringing the message of healing and restoration for nations. And see, God wants to give you just a glimpse of what it can be. That is the carrot in front of the donkey's face. You may be in the midst of the fire and the suffering, but this weekend it's like He's giving you a picture of what is going to be, because it's already all within you. Every bit of healing and liberty and freedom and identity and the purposes of God is already in you, and it's being pushed to the forefront. It's being pushed out of the birthing process. It's right now in the season of transition. I believe the church in the season of transition more now than ever before in recent history. And of course, the season of transition and the birthing process is the most dangerous of all. It's the roughest of all. One of the roughest places to traverse on any trip offshore going fishing is not 50 miles from land. One of the roughest places is the mouth of the inlet, where the water in the bay, and this is where you're at right now, where it's like the church has been in the bay, where there's everything safe here. But our sight's so limited, and if the wind blows a little bit too quickly, we can be on land in just a second. That's where most Christians live. That's no fun. Because we can see right out the mouth of that inlet to the expanse and the ocean of like one tuna fisherman. Where's he at? Where's he at? For sure, there he is over there. Man, he caught a 90-something pound tuna 80, 100 miles offshore, and he said, yeah! And if you ever experience that, but see, to get to that place, you've got to pass through the transitional place, the mouth of the inlet, the sandbar, the place to where many may never make it across the bar out into the ocean of God's love, where the harvest of all the wealth and the riches and the glory and the love of God is there for you. We're in the birthing canal. We're coming into the mouth of the inlet, and when a fishing boat's pulling from the calm waters of the bay, everything has got to be put in its place. Anything not tied down, put in its place. When you hit the waters of the inlet, the waters, at least in shallower water inlets, are pretty rough, and you've got to ease your way across the bar. Because if you don't cross the bar just right, I think of the time when I was just a mate, first year I was a mate, 13 years old, working out of Ponce Inlet, Florida. I was on a sport fishing boat, and at that time, there wasn't jetties, and Ponce Inlet was known as one of the roughest, most dangerous inlets in the East Coast because the sandbar was so shallow, and there was no jetties, rocks out there that helped keep the channel deep, and the channel would shift. One day, it would be shallow on this side of the channel, and the other day, it'd be shallow on that side of the inlet. And each day, all the fishing boats would line up about 6:30 in the morning, and they'd take time to ease their way out across the bar. And if you didn't cross the bar at just the right angle, then disaster could occur. And we had all these tourists on the boat wanting to go offshore for the day. And the roughest part of the day was, can we get our vessel across the bar out in the ocean to where harvest takes place? And we're right behind the Broadbill, about a 50-foot headboat that had about 40 passengers on it, all going out snapper and grouper fishing. And you had to wait until the big swells came in. And right after the swells, a set of swells would pass. You would run out as fast as you could because the bottom was so shallow there on the bar. If a big swell lifted up the bow, the propellers would hit into the sand. And the Broadbill misjudged it. And they took off right across the bar right after three waves, and most sets of in Florida are sets of three. Three big waves, rollers came in. But this time, the Broadbill took off and a fourth one came in. Lifted up the bow, the propeller went right down into the dirt, into the sandbar, bent the propeller, bent the shaft on it. The power was lost. The boat now turned sideways. The next set of waves came in, hit them, rolled them up on their side. People were almost washed out of the boat. They're fighting for their lives. And these aren't seamen. These are tourists. Now all the other crews are laughing. I mean, when you live in the beach community, tourists aren't your friends. I mean that, you know. But my captain knew immediately he needed to rescue him. And we went in there. He had me up on the bow, throw a line to them as they're trying to drag everybody back into the vessel. The waves were threatening to take the lives of people. And we towed the Broadbill on in. That's where the church is at right now. The Broadbill, for over a week, lost its ability to harvest because they didn't cross the bar at the right angle. We lost time to be able to harvest because we lost several hours taking them back and having to get them back in the slip and get a boat tied up without power. And we finally went out late. But see, it never affects one person. When one person misjudges the moment of transition season that the church is, it always affects others and endangers lives. And that's why it is so important to understand this season of the birthing process. It's the last days, and the book of Exodus is a prophetic word for those of us that live in the last days. And now we see, we want to talk about the beginning of birth pains, that the road of Egypt is all about spiritual warfare. It's all about God that is moving all the political powers of the world system that be, and the enemy doing everything to stop it and to fight against it. And as we go through these principles, there's going to be 7 principles of birthing of deliverance in your life. 7 principles of birthing that helps us get across the bar and out into a place to where we can reap harvest. And start at verse 1 in Exodus 2. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, take note of that, we'll see that again. When she saw that she was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. Now we know that Moses' parents' name, we see later on in Exodus, father was Amram, and his mother was Jochebed. And they made a decision to go against the world system of that moment. And we see in the later verses of chapter 1 that we skipped over that Egypt and Pharaoh had become afraid of the people, and even though they put them under harsh bondage, that they made an edict that every male child born would be killed. But we see that Shipra and Puah, that Hebrew midwives, end up saving the lives of the children, that they were blessed. And so the command of all of Egypt now is to destroy the children. And because the midwives feared God and wouldn't participate in that, in verse 22, Pharaoh now commands that any baby you see, kill them. And see the principles behind this. If Satan cannot stop you from being fruitful, he goes after your children. And we know that so well in society today. He first goes after us, but the people of God continue to be fruitful and multiply in spite of the rigor, in spite of the bondage. So Satan says, kill their kids. Destroy their kids. Don't let them enter into this freedom with their children. And then a mother and father, Amram, Jochebed, come forth during this time, and they say, we'll not yield to that system. And they begin to hide their child. Now, the entire nation in verse 22 is committed against to suicide or genocide of the people of God. And most people's attitude during that time was just to cave in, to crawl into a hole somewhere, just give in as every male-born child is being killed. But not Amram and Jochebed. And all through the Old Testament, in the New Testament, names are very important. And it's very important to understand as we move into 7 principles of birthing deliverance, the name and what it means. Amram means the people or kinsmen are exalted. The people or kinsmen are exalted. They were from the family of Kohath. Amram from the family of Kohath, which means to ally oneself. The Kohath family, find it interesting. As you go through history, you'll see the family of Kohath ministered in the tabernacle under David, assisting in returning the Ark of the Lord, served with song in the house of the Lord, stood and praised God during battle, led reform movement under Hezekiah, cleansed the house of the Lord. Under Josiah, they were set over constructing the temple. In this, we can see that our choices shape families and the destiny of families for generations to come. They refused to learn to yield to the world system, and it was going to have repercussions over yet their family. Again, what we focus our life on will carry over into generation and generation to come. I often say, every act of obedience that we choose today, our children are going to inherit from that act of obedience. Our grandchildren are going to inherit, our great-grandchildren. But the opposite, every act of Egypt we choose to be enslaved to today, it's beginning to be imparted to generation to come. And the name Kohath, as we look and see those that ally their oneselves to God, it affects the generations. Amram chose to go against the system and not to believe that destruction would come to his house. He did not know that his son would be the very one that would take them from bondage. But he did know He wouldn't let the world system control him. He wouldn't let it dictate his life. And Jochebed, her name meant God is the glory. She also was a Kohathite. And here we see principle number one. They made a decision to identify with the people of God. They knew they would never do anything in the kingdom of God alone. Amram's name testifies of that. The people are exalted. And so many people today get hurt within the body. They get hurt within the church. And they choose, I'm going to separate myself from that situation. But years later, they're barren. Because God is after freedom and fruitfulness. Satan is after bondage and barrenness. Papa John is now 67 years old. We call him Papa John because he's better than a pizza. In the 1960s, he graduated Duke University and his master's in counseling and theology, and later his doctorates in theology. He became a Methodist pastor. And he just always had a passion and a heart that he wanted to see the lost drawn in. He wanted to see the broken restored. He had such a heart for wounded and broken people, and his whole passion was healing to the wounded, healing to the ones everybody else threw away, to those that the most cast down from society. And God began to use him as a Methodist pastor in his churches. And then someone took him to some weird four gospel businessmen meeting, and he got filled with the Holy Spirit. And in a short time, he got the left foot of fellowship after 9 years of pastoring. It broke his heart. At a time when the presence of God was beginning to fulfill his dream, what happens when God gives you a word? Then all the circumstances begin to go contrary to the word that God gives you. You start going through the testing last night, and God gave him a word. Some of the words he gave him, you're going to be going into Cuba, you're going to be going into Poland, you're going to be going into Japan. And gave him visions of different countries where he was going to be going in ministering to the wounded and brokenhearted. And when the word of God came to him, the fire of testing came. And then for 25 years, he rejected the people of God. He walked with God. He had church with his children and home every Sunday. He followed the principles of God and continued to be faithful in his life. He belonged to four gospel businessmen, and his wife belonged to the handmaidens and intercessors organizations. But they rejected the church because the church was the source of betrayal and hurt and pain in his life. But see, Amram and Jochebed, they aligned themselves to the people of God. They allied themselves, Kohathites. And all the dreams and the vision that God had given Johnny never came to pass. And like so many people in ministry that have been trained for ministry, he didn't know how to do anything else, so you go to work in construction. And he built houses for 25 years. And the word God gave him never came to pass. He continued to walk with God. He continued to go to the motions, but he didn't want anything to do with organized church. He says they're a source of pain. His filter was the being fired many years ago when the Holy Spirit first began to pour out in the charismatic renewal among the denominations. And then during a time of season of fasting and prayer, God showed him that for 25 years, he'd left his bones in Egypt. He held on and related to the people of God from the hurt that the people of God had brought him in the past. Anybody ever not been hurt in church? And God told him, "Ally yourself to the church." And he started going in the early 90s to the church that we've been a part of since we left the Salvation Army. There with Pastor Philip, such an awesome guy that, oh, even in his imperfections, that his whole passion is to see you mature in the gift of God and the heart of God and to grow into your maximum potential in the gifts and the kingdom and in the things God is calling you to. And he saw the gift of intercession and prayer upon Johnny's life and put him over intercession and prayer and began to take the church into seasons of prayer. And he saw the gift of healing on his life and took him through training in prayer ministry and went through training through the Sanford's ministry. And he started ministering healing to people and God started using him. But God had told him, the nations you'll go to. You'll go to these nations and healing and liberty and freedom. You'll be going into Nigeria and healing and liberty and freedom. And then he knew I was going to Poland and he came to me in 1994 or 5 and says, Jack, I've always dreamed of going to Poland. I feel like I've had a word. I'm to go there. Can I just go and pray for you? Come on, Johnny, go with me. As soon as he stepped foot on Polish ground, he just started weeping. He didn't stop weeping for 8 days. He couldn't stop crying. The pastors that were so skeptical that were in these retreat meetings with us, they said at the end, we couldn't stop watching Johnny cry for us. So many people come over here, one pastor said, just to get another brownie button. I've been to this country. But Johnny cared for us. And it melted the hearts and the walls. And he came home and couldn't stop crying for the Polish people for weeks. And then he said, oh, this is my dream. I can't stand building houses anymore. And he went bankrupt. And he was doing quite well until 3 people didn't pay him. One of them a pastor. And he had to go work for someone else. And it was a nightmare, living with an abusive authoritarian boss and as a foreman on a job, and he'd come home shattered and broken. Can you relate? Living in the midst of Egypt. And then as he chose to identify with the people of God, it seems like all circumstances go worse. And finally, Shiloh Place begins to break forth in 99. And Johnny travels as we'd pay for him to go to the nations, and he'd try to get time off and time off. But the dream and the word God gave him after 30 years still hadn't come to pass. But after 5 years of aligning himself with the people of God, the finances came available to bring Johnny on full time, Shiloh Place. And after 30 years of the test of delay, the word that God gave him came to pass. And ministers from the nations come, and I've never seen such an anointing on Johnny. He's just a country boy and hardly's got any teeth. One world leader I'd brought in to meet with Johnny, he came out at lunch and said to me, I stepped in the room with that guy and all I thought, this is just a country hick. What he's got for me? He talks like he's from some place back in the woods that hadn't seen the light of day ever. And I sat there with such an attitude, and he just listened, and he just listened. But when he opened his voice, it was like a hammer that went straight to the core issues of my heart. And Johnny's preparing to go to Nigeria to a conference with 2,000 Methodist ministers, with John Arnott, and to Cuba, the thousands of Methodist pastors, and the very ones that didn't understand the dealings of God in his life. As Johnny came along Shiloh Place, I sent him back to the Eastern North Carolina conference. He stood before the elders board and all the pastors, some of them who had rejected him, and the overseer of the Eastern North Carolina Conference, and got on his knees before him, and he says, I want to ask y'all to forgive me for 25 years rejecting you, speaking against you. I've sinned against the Methodist Church. And I'm asking you to forgive me. And weeping and crying, the whole place began to break down and cry. And when the overseer could finally stop weeping, he says, there's a move of the Holy Spirit in Eastern North Carolina, and you're just the man to begin to facilitate that. And the Methodist Church is opening its arms to him to bring the revelation of God's love. But see, it doesn't happen to us alone. You don't see the Word of God. It comes with an aligning ourselves to the purposes of God within our own lives and in the lives of others. And principle number two in birthing, Amram and Jochebed were willing for God to give birth to something that would be an answer to the needs of the world. In the midst of their devastation, death all around them, grief all around them, wailing and emptiness and despair throughout the entire people of God, and now their own child on the line, they were willing to give birth to the answer of the needs of mankind. The needs of mankind today, fatherlessness all over the earth. It's the most fatherless time in world history, inside the church, outside the church. The devastation and pain as we've traveled all over the nations on every continent. America is the most emotionally healthy people and country I've come across. Is this world in trouble? And 82% of Americans are emotionally unhealthy. 58% have mild to moderate mental health problems and 24% moderate to major mental health problems that can be seen through anxieties, fear, depression, addictions, an inability to be flexible and change, manipulation, control. And we're the healthiest country out there. But are you willing to give birth to something in you? Are you willing to go through the birth pains necessary, the transitional season of giving birth, the suffering, the travail that people go through, that mothers go through, to give birth to something that can be an answer to the world? And God told us in December of 1980, you'll take healing and restoration to the nations. Other people influenced that. Our own definition of that was we were going to be a missionary. And for me, I wanted a third world country. Give me the jungle where there's not a lot of people. All I dreamed of is put me on one of these missionary boats to where all I have to do, I've got my captain's license, I'm licensed to captain vessels up to 150 feet in length. I can just captain that boat, put me in the wheelhouse, close the doors, and don't let me have to deal with people. They need boat captains on the mission field. But if you put me near hip people, I'm going to hurt somebody. And that was our definition. And all of our preparation in life was healing and restoration to the nations by going into the jungles, this adventurous personality. And we were scheduled to go to the Philippines in 1988 and had everything, the emails, the phone calls going back and forth. My wife was willing to go. She was being faithful. And then the whole world and things collapsed in the Philippines and that whole thing fell apart. And we couldn't go. And then we looked at Brazil in 1989, and they needed somebody to captain a 70-foot medical boat up the Amazon River. And we went down and spent 10 days on the Amazon River on the boat, and it was awesome. And it was everything I wanted, just cruising the jungles and the adventure and new tribes and villages every day, taking in the medical and then winning them one-on-one to the Lord. And I said, this is it. And then they said, your children will have to go in boarding school. You'll see them once every 3 months. And my wife said, no way. And that collapsed. And then 1990, the Philippines opened up for us to head up Bible schools throughout the Philippines. I mean, that was 1988. And 1990, Mexico opened up for us to go down and be among the Mayans. Established the Zona Maya Bible College, no Bible school for the Mayans. Bible schools for the Mexicans, but Mayans and Mexicans do not come close to one another. Tremendous hatred. What took place among the American Indians here took place above the Mayans in the Yucatan Peninsula, slaughtered and killed by the Mexicans. The scum of the earth in Mexico. And they had 10,000 square miles of villages and tens of thousands of Mayans and no one to equip them. And we make several trips down there and all the plans are made and then the Mayans won't let us in. Another person that had control of getting us in. There was issues that occurred there. The Mayans wouldn't let us rent a house in Carrillo Preto and the whole thing died. And it's like giving birth to a dead baby. For 10 years, all the preparation of your life, and every time you're right at a point in entering into the word that you think God gives you, all the circumstances in life go against it. And by December 1990, we died. Disappointment. People letting you down. And that was it. And my wife and I were ready to resign the ministry and go back to sea of fishing. And in the midst of death, despair, everything I'd lived for, leaving the sea, all these years wasted. All the pain, the preparation, the devastation of our family wasted. And we're sitting December 22nd, 1990, our anniversary, on steak and ale. And I asked my wife the question I've asked many people, and we'd resigned the church, didn't know what was going to happen to our lives. But I knew I just don't have it for another human being again. I can't put trust in another person again. In the midst of the betrayal and the devastation and the disappointment, God birthed something in us that would be an answer for the needs of mankind. And in the midst of the greatest fire and devastation of your life, are you willing to birth something that's going to be an answer for your family first? An answer for your church? An answer for your city? As I asked my wife the simple question, if money were not an option, which we had not one dime, and we could do anything with our life, with what God's given us and done, what would it be? And she wrote it down on a napkin, and I wrote it down on a napkin. And the words that we'd heard twice before, to build a place of healing and restoration, where just broken, shattered, wounded people can come and find healing, find love, and find rest. She wrote the words healing and restoration retreat, and I wrote them down. And we read it, and we both cried. The whole world, the church, everything against our lives. Only one or two people still willing to even believe in us. Nobody hardly believed in us at that time. We didn't even believe in ourselves. And Amram and Jochebed, in the midst of that devastation, much, much, 100 times as great as what my wife and I were. They were willing to give birth to something. They didn't know it was going to be the answer to the need of the people of God. Are we going to be so focused on our pain we're not willing to give birth to something? And we went to our pastor and said, we feel like we're to establish a Shiloh place. Shiloh, rest and tranquility. A place of rest and tranquility where just hurting leaders in the body of Christ can come. He said, I believe that's you. I believe that's you. We called people on the phone that we'd believed and trusted, and so many people said, "We're going to get behind you. We're going to be with you. We're going to support you. We're going to be there for you. We believe that's you, and we're willing to give birth." Now, how many of those people ended up there? We stepped out with not a dime, but promises from so many people that they'd be there. And I can count on one hand how many followed through. Even in the midst of the betrayal of those who walk with me in the house of God, are you willing to nurture the word that God has given you? 1991, a family of five lived on $18,000. Don't ask me how. I don't know how. But we had a word. In the midst of devastation, in the midst of death and vision, a place of healing and restoration. Pharaoh doesn't fear you as a Christian. But what he does fear is that you will come out of your identity being in that devastation. What he does fear is you coming out of the pain and embracing a willingness to give birth to something that's an answer for the needs of others. He is terrified by that. And he will do everything to alter the circumstances in your life to make it look that everything is contrary. A place of healing and restoration in our devastation. Suddenly, life began to come to us. And energy and life, as the pastor says, I believe in it. I'll help you. And thank God he helped us. He gave us 3 months starter salary to start us off and saying, "I believe that's who you are. I don't believe with the gifts God gives you, you need to be locked in a jungle. I believe you can minister to the hurting and wounded because you've known not so much pain." But then the number of people that also said they would, and they just fell by the way. They fell by the way. And God's made it very clear that first day, that first year. Get your eyes off the people that promised to be there. Because if your eyes are on them, you make them your source and not me. Keep your eyes on the Word. Keep your eyes on the vision. Keep your eyes on who the real source is, because people aren't the source. The local church is not the source. God's love is the source. And don't let the failure of others separate you from your alignment with the people of God. Because people will let you down, but I never left you down. And see, Pharaoh knows. He knows that people focused upon covenant can be the downfall. And so he seeks to destroy the word. He seeks to destroy the children. He deals with this craftily, and it leads us right into principle number 3. I think I said 7 principles, but I really believe it's probably 6. 6 principles. Principle number 3, Amram and Jochebed had a healthy fear of God and the lack of the fear of man and what Pharaoh could do to them. They were not afraid of Pharaoh's commands. Look with me just a moment at Hebrews 11:23. Why weren't they afraid? What happened to cause them to go against everything that if they would be caught, they would be put to death as well as the child? If they were caught hiding Moses, what would happen to them? And they're listed in the hall of faith because of this. And in Hebrews 11:23, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw that he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's edicts. The key of that little word there is that word beautiful. In Greek, that word beautiful is city. That Moses had the look of the city of God upon him. We saw it again in Exodus 2, verse 2. He had this countenance about him. He had the look of the city. And four times in Hebrews, it speaks of the people of faith seeking for a city which was not built in the natural, but a city that's in the heavenly realm. And Moses had this look of the city. Why would Pharaoh's own daughter go against Pharaoh's commands when she saw that it was this a Hebrew child that was placed in the river? Because this child had the look of the city of God on it. And see, why would Amram and Jochebed risk the entire family? Because of the word agonai in Hebrew. Faith in Hebrew is agonai. The word we get agony from. They had a suffering. They had a faith that they knew there was something unusual about this child. Even Pharaoh's daughter saw that in them. There was something of life. And see, there's something unusual about you. Something special that God has put inside of every one of us that has the look of the city, not the look of the world system. And Amram saw that. He saw that. And he was willing to risk the life of his family, the life of his other children, the life of Moses, because of the look of the city on it. It had the look of the blessing of God. And see, when we begin to follow after the word that God gives us, why would I spend so much time? People that travel with me say, I don't know how you do this. Every other week, leaving family to go into a city, coming home spent and exhausted and risking the warfare that those of you that have moved towards ministry and the word that God has given you, you've seen the warfare that comes when you move towards the word that God gives you. The enemy comes in and tries to stop that. He begins to author the circumstances that bring betrayal, that bring hurt, that brings everything against the word. Why do people risk that? Because of the look of the city. The look of the city of God. So many times my wife and I tried to quit. I mean, she's turned in more written resignations. But see, Shiloh Place has the look of the city upon it of God. And even in the first year when there's never over 10 cents in the bank account, when every dollar that came in is already paid out, just trying to put enough food on the table, and the only way you could eat is finding groceries at your door, and the hunters in the area leaving the deer whole. At least they were skinned, thank you. For me to have to sit up at night and trim all the meat off and pack it away so we could eat. And the half-acre garden that we tilled by hand, and having to fill the freezers just so we could eat. And just people seeing the holes in your kids' shoes and bringing shoes and clothing to your family, because $18,000 doesn't go far in Myrtle Beach with three children and two adults. But see, it had the look of the city. Every person that would come, and we'd spend 2 or 3 days ministering to, a week or two later, a letter would arrive of their lives being changed and transformed, and we put it in a file. And now the file cabinets are full, and every time the enemy had us looking at the circumstance, looking at the bank account, looking at the poverty, looking at our kids' shoes, we'd go back to the file. And Shiloh Place had the look of a city. I can't tell you how many times the file cabinet saved our destiny and our purpose. There's not a week that goes by But fishing boats don't call me. I can go down and they're talking to me. But it's about the look of the city. And see, I can't afford any longer. I can't afford any longer risking the life of my children when the enemy sought to destroy them and almost has. Risking it upon something that has the look of man to it. I can't afford any longer putting my finances, my energy, my time into something that does not have the look of the city of God. But when you find something that is touching and transforming and is being an answer for the needs of mankind, people are drawn to that. I'm drawn to that. And oh, I get in pity parties at least every week. When you come home after 3 or 4 days of awesome move of God and miracles, first day home's usually the pity party. You in ministry know what I mean. You're spent, and in that moment of weakness, the father of lies comes to you and say, "What are you doing this for? Why are you giving yourself to this? Look what you could be doing in the world. Look at the nations. Look at the seas. Look at your gifts and talents and your ability and your sea." And I hadn't put my Bible degrees on the wall, but I do have my captain's license still there that I renew every 5 years. And I turn around and look at my computer, and there's the pictures of my dad and I when we were young, and the big giant fish hanging there, and my captain's license right there. But I found even when I put it in the attic, I can still hear it calling me. So I might as well leave it there. So my wife and kids come to me this past year, and they said, "You know, my wife says you've given up everything. That was your passion and your dreams for us. Oh, at first you did it for a name and a reputation, but then something changed. And I realized the sacrifice you've given." And Jesus said, if a man is willing to give up houses and families and things for the sake of the gospel in this life, He'll give you 100 times more. And see, my dreams for the nations, my dream to sail the Southern Ocean, and one of my dreams is just to get on sailboats and to sail for weeks. And I just said, "Oh, I don't want to be run by the desires of Egypt anymore." My wife says, "You know, we can pay the bills for the first time since we entered ministry. Why don't you take the royalties on the book over the next year? And I want you to find the greatest adventure you can go on and go for a month. I don't care what it costs. Anything you want to do, anywhere in the world you want to go." I said, "Really? You don't care what it costs?" December 26, I fly to Ushuaia and Southern Argentina and pick up a 74-foot sailboat and sail to Antarctica for a month. A buddy going with me is a sailor out of Boston, and the dream, you see, you may give up what was a dream and passion, but when something has the look of the city, you don't care what you sacrifice. You don't care what you're willing to let go of because it has the look of the city. It may cost you your life. It may risk your family, but you're willing to let it go because you're willing to give birth to something that's a need for the answer of the things of the world. But then God's not going to let you give up something that as the motive for that thing changes, He doesn't come back and say, "There, it's yours now again. It's yours now again." And every 2 years now, I'm going to be taking off with Skip Novak, the top round-the-world Southern Ocean sailor, and sailing the oceans of the world with him for 4- and 6-week trips. And my wife says, "Fulfill your life dreams. Go." And I pleaded with my kids to go, but they didn't like the prospect of 75-mile-an-hour winds and 50-foot seas in the Southern Ocean. So they say, go. And see, you can't give up, but for a season, that which God's going to restore back to you. If you're willing to give birth to something that's an answer for the needs. And principle number four is the birthing of deliverance. They had the willingness to hide, to nourish, and to raise up through patience and intercession the covenant purposes of God in their life. Let me repeat that. Principle number five of birthing four. They had a willingness to hide, to nurture, and to raise up through patience and intercession the covenant purpose of God in His timing. The word that God has given you. How many times did the Egyptian soldiers come close to catching baby Moses crying? But see, they were willing to go through the agony, the risk. They wouldn't fear man. They were willing to nurture that. How many times did they hold Moses in their arms and speak the words of life, words of healing, intercession into that little child, call forth? It speaks about this in Acts 7, verse 20. When Stephen was holding account for his actions before the Sanhedrin. And he said in the previous verse, at this time, in Greek that means in this season of crisis, speaking of Moses and of Amram and Jochebed, in this season of crisis, for 3 months Moses was nurtured in the Father's house. For 3 months he was nurtured in his Father's house. That word nurture in Greek means to cause something to rise and come forth. And for those 3 months of fear and anxiety and grief and pain, every time Jochebed nursed Moses, she's speaking principles of God, life, liberty, freedom in them. They nurtured the gift of God within them. They were bringing the promise of the Word, interceding over it, travailing over it. And as God spoke healing to the nations, as we came and we realized in Shiloh Place began in January 1991, out of the devastation, once more God brings us in remembrance of the Word. You'll take healing and restoration to the nations. And we began to realize it's not a jungle thing. It's not us hidden away on a boat in the jungle. He's not calling us to one nation. We misunderstood that all these years. He didn't say we would take healing and restoration to a nation. The word He'd given us is you will take healing and restoration to the nations of the earth. And we, yes! It's not us being in one place. It's God giving birth to something out of the devastation of our lives, taking what was meant as evil against us and turning it around for good. Joseph, out of the devastation and betrayal, was willing to give birth to becoming the preserver of the world, the answer to the crisis in the world. And in our devastation, poverty, brokenness, the first year betrayal, nobody there for us. Except for 3 or 4 people sending in small checks of $25, $50, what they can afford. One man, I remember, every month the $200 would come. And that $200 check was the groceries every month. It would get us by and it would come in and it was like precious gold to us in our devastation. No one there for us. And we were willing to nurture that. And I had hardly no ministry, no meetings. People coming in every day. I tried going back to sea fishing. We were living a mile from Merle's Inlet, and I'd go down and I'd get one of the commercial fishing boats when a guy was taking a week off, and I'd go to sea and I'd pull a broker. Nothing. I'd put out $300 or $400 to ice and get enough groceries and food to go out for 2 or 3 days, and I couldn't even catch enough to fill the boxes. And I wondered what happened to the gift of God I had. He won't let you use Egypt to get your needs met. He wants you operating by agony, faith, believing in the substance of things hoped for, And I'd come back and my wife would work as a substitute teacher. And she said, why don't you try that? So I said, I'll try that. We couldn't get a real job because we had ministers coming in and we had to be there when they called to come. And if they weren't there, we had to make a dollar somewhere. I did one term of Egypt. That was enough. Those little rugrats like that drove me crazy. I thought I was going to kill them. They gave me PE class in the winter, and all they had was a little portable classroom to put all those kids in. I mean, I crawled out of that place, and they poured me in my car and had to drive me home. I mean, I couldn't even do that. There wasn't grace for fishing left. There wasn't grace for substitute teaching left. And he says, just fast and pray. Just fast. There's nothing in the refrigerator worth eating anyway. Just fast. And I put in 1991, probably 90 days of fasting. And I'd just get alone while my wife's substitute teaching, and I'd go out into the garden. People said, we've never seen a garden so clean in our life. Yeah, I didn't have anything else to do but pull weeds. And say, oh God, where is the answer to this word you've given us? Where's the answer? And I kept being reminded of the teaching that I had developed in the big church I was on staff and taught all the other ministers to be. Until the word comes to pass that I give you, it'll try you. And he says, the word is for an appointed time. It shall come. Write it down. It shall not tarry. And at the point when we're ready to resign and quit because my wife just couldn't take it anymore, never knowing where the next tennis shoes were going to come from or the next piece of meat was going to come from, I went into 5 days alone with God fasting. It's all in the series here. If this is you and this is your season, pulling down strongholds through prayer and fasting, are you willing to fast and intercede for the word that God has given you to come to reality? Every 3 months for 5 years, I would go into solitude for 5 days, just sitting there alone with God, crying out, where are you, God? 5 years of poverty, barely able to survive, barely able to feed my family. And after the first year, alone, 3 job opportunities, $50,000 salaries given to me. One, my closest confidant and friend calling and saying, if you'll just be my associate pastor, I know I can get you $40,000, $50,000 a year, and you don't know where the next food is coming from. I mean, when the word that God gives you about to come to pass, Satan will bring in a counterfeit word over and over and over and over again. It will look good, but it's not the best for the purposes of God. And we had that one, and my personal closest friend and confidant and pastor saying, just come to work for me. Come in and do counseling just 3 days a week for me. Give me 3 full days, and we can get you at least $1,000 a month. Just do that, and you can have your other ministry on the side. And then a church saying, just come as our senior pastor. 200 people. You get paid every Monday if you preach good. And we go into that with the fourth option. The suffering of this present time won't near compare with the glory that lies ahead. Even though you're a son, Jack, learn obedience in this season for the suffering, and you'll become a source of eternal salvation for many. 4 days, God, give me a word. God, I'm hungry. Get this word over so I can eat. Give me a word. I'll not eat until I've got a word. What for are you calling me to? And he said, write it down. And I started writing. I didn't like what I was writing. And I wrote, and I wrote what I didn't know at the same moment, the same hour, my wife's home, and she's writing. Not a dollar in the bank. Many of you know what that's like. If you're given $200, it's gone as fast as you can write checks and pay the bills and the light bill and the rent. And for the next 20 pages, I wrote out the vision of what Shiloh Place is today. In fact, not even today, what it's going to be about 5 years from now. Weeping and crying and travailing and trying to talk God out of writing it down and writing something else down. And I called my wife and I said, I have a word. And she says, I have it too. She drove to the north end of the beach where I was staying in a friend's condo praying alone. And God gave her the same word as she gave me in the midst of our devastation. It's all about a refiner's fire. That the word I gave you shall come to pass. It'll tarry for a little while, yes. And every 3 months I'd go back in and say, God, do in me what's necessary for my character to sustain the calling to keep healing and restoration for the nations. And I'd weep and I'd cry and I'd be alone and I'd go home and I'd still make the nations first and not my wife and family. And it took hundreds of days of fast for me to finally see it's not about the nations being touched until first that faith rises up in my family. And Amram and Jochebed went through the suffering, the agony, the faith of that family, and they were willing to give birth into that thing. You see, faith is not only birthing, but it is nourishing. It's believing. It's suffering. Faith is agony. It's the season of agony. And from 1991 to 1997, travailing, interceding, agonizing, barely enough money to get by. This person forgetting me, this person forgetting me. This person coming into our life saying they'd be there and there for a season, and they gone. Another person coming in saying, I'm going to be there for a season, and they're gone. The test of the brethren over and over again. The test of the family over and over again. The test of circumstances over and over again. The test of delay over and over again. And meanwhile, the fire burning, burning, burning. And when we used to melt lead for our sinkers, we would be in there. And as we're melting the lead, all this slag and garbage would rise to the surface and scraping it off and putting it down and scraping it off and putting it down and then dropping lead pipe into the vat. And every now and then there'd just be a spot of dew on there and the lead pipe would go in and it'd explode and the refiner's fire would burn you and go all over you. And this is just like boiling lead. Walking with God and the Word God gave us is just like the refiner's fire. Oh, in Germany, Scott said, I'm just looking for God to just snap His fingers. And one great climactic event, and we're there. Americanized Christianity has invaded the rest of the countries of the world. As I sat in China, smuggled and hidden and driven down many back streets, brought in the back door of a little restaurant and then have to sit there for an hour in the back room, darkness all around. And then on comes a man that looked probably 80 or 90 years old, just crippled and hunched over and his feet broken. Found out later he was just in his 60s. An attendant on both sides sits him in the table across from me. And the translator telling me his name. An apostolic figure over 3,000 churches. And he begins to tell me about his 28 years in prison. And every day drug out to the beating stands. Renounce Christ, or they tied you up and they beat the bottoms of your feet and twisted your arms and mangled your body recant or they beat him every day into unconsciousness. And he tells the story of the many of his friends that were released from prison because they rejected Christ. Now take this Americanized Christianity over into those prison camps. And so much of Christianity says, oh, that's sin. That's a lack of faith. I've never felt so much like a worm and so humbled in my life to know I would have been probably released from prison early. Because I'm too Americanized in this American Christianity. And after 28 years of never recanting, he was released from prison, a broken, shattered man, and established in his brokenness and broken body 3,000 underground house churches all over the Beijing area. The sufferings of this present time don't near compare with the glory that lies ahead. And we're in the book of Exodus in these end times. I don't know what all that means, but I know that the future isn't going to be all lovey-dovey-dovey and peace. It comes through devastation that the church is purified. And I asked him, what is your greatest fear for the church in China? What is it that can hinder the revival that is happening? If the church embraces the American gospel, it will die. Because it's the fires of suffering and persecution that are feeding the revival. And when the church becomes acceptable, it loses its passion and fire. And when I'm tempted to return in my resignation, I try to go back there for a few minutes. I try to be in that little back room. Are we willing to nourish the gift that God has given us? To fast, to suffer, to intercede, to believe. Oh. And so many of the years between 91 and 97, I think I was only willing to for about 10% of the time. But that 10% was something. The rest of the time, my eyes were focused on this person should have done that. That person hasn't done this. This person let me down. This person promised, and I kept learning over and over again. Oh, stop looking to the person and start looking to the source. And every time my wife and I ran into somebody of means that we thought they have the ability to help us, we'd have to go home and say, forgive us, Lord. Forgive us, Lord. Forgive us. It's not them. Because every time I think others are my source, I delay the fulfillment of the vision of God. And I've stopped nurturing faith. And I was in Japan with A.S. Worley a number of years back. And I heard him teach one of the greatest messages on faith that I've ever heard. He said, when my wife and I go to town, and you have to know A.S. Worley, all I look for is an ice cream store. I can see every ice cream stand and store, and I don't pass any of them. But my wife, she sees all the clothing stores. She sees the fabric shops. And she stops at the ice cream stand with me, and then I go into the fabric shop with her. And she holds up this big piece of cloth and says, "Look at this beautiful dress. Can't you see it, honey?" And I can't see it. But I can find ice cream stores anywhere, but I can't see the dress my wife sees. And he says, "Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." And that fabric is faith. It's a substance. It's something. And I can't see it, but she can. And then she goes into her sewing room, and she won't let me in there because she's afraid I'm going to spill my ice cream on it. Oh, I love A.S. Worley. He and I have a lot in common. And she goes in with that fabric and she starts sewing on it. And trimming and nurturing and caring for it. And then one day she walks out with this beautiful dress on and she says, "Honey, look at me." And I finally see what I could never see before. But she had faith, the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. And God's giving you a word. And are you sowing on it? Nurturing it? When you eat an egg, do you eat the whole chicken? Mm-hmm. When you hold an acorn in your hand, you hold the entire tree. And see, everything you're ever going to be already resides in you. It's in you. The ability to give birth to something that's an answer for your broken, shattered family, cousins, uncles, parents, it's in you. The ability to give birth to something that's an answer for the need of your church, your city, your nation. It's right here at the crossing. It's in you individually and corporately. But see, it's about willingness to give birth to something. But then a willingness to nurture that. And then John 13:34-35 becomes a reality. As Jesus says, "A new commandment that I give you. As you're wearing that beautiful garment of love that you've sewn upon, fasted for, prayed for, nurtured, the world will come to know that I sent you." An agape reformation.
If you would like to order this product or any other material available at Shiloh Place Ministries, you may reach us at 843-365-8990 or write to us at Shiloh Place Ministries, P.O. Box 5, Conway, South Carolina, 29528. Either way, we'd love to hear from you. For our friends comfortable with the computer, visit our website at www.shilohplace.org or you may email us at info@shilohplace.org.